This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Well, thank you very much, Roger. Good morning. As I said to Matt a few minutes ago, I probably shouldn't even mention the temperature in Arizona at the moment, because right now I'm looking at a thermometer that says 50 degrees here in the Valley of the Sun. And so to Farm Bureau members who are listening this morning and who will be heading for the Valley of the Sun for the convention, I think you'll like your temperatures here a little better than you will back in the Midwest. The convention gets underway with some of the preliminary activities and events tomorrow, and then seriously gets underway on Sunday. I think a lot of people are looking forward to the keynote speakers at this year's Farm Bureau Convention. Archie Manning and his son Peyton are the keynote speakers at the Farm Bureau Convention, talking about partnerships and working together in any kind of a business, agriculture, or whatever else it might be. But we are at 9 minutes after 5 o'clock here on the Saturday morning show, as we continue our coverage from here in the West, where they're beginning to get some pretty good water again, particularly in California. Some heavy snows in the Sierras in the forecast for today. And of course, when we get snow in the mountains, that's good news for San Francisco, for Los Angeles, for Phoenix, for all of those cities that draw water from the Colorado River. So snow in the mountains will be welcomed by farmers and ranchers here in the West. Well, we're going to talk land values, farmland values, in light of the ongoing decline in the commodity prices. And are we seeing the steep decline also occur in farmland values? We're going to find out. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ray Brownfield, who can answer our questions on farmland value when we continue here on the Saturday morning show. 12 minutes after 5 o'clock here on this Saturday morning, and I'm glad our first guest this morning grew up on a farm, because he knows about getting up early, because we are doing that to him this morning. It's interesting, the world of technology. We have Bob Ferguson, our engineer, in the studios at WGN in downtown Chicago. I'm sitting in the WGN West studio in Scottsdale, Arizona. And Ray Brownfield is at his home in Naperville, Illinois. And somehow, Ray, I think we're all coming together. So good morning.
Good morning to you, Orion. And also, it is a balmy 5 below 0 here in Naperville this morning. So I hope you're enjoying your weather.
We are enjoying the weather. I don't want to mention it too much, because people say, hey, don't rub it in. But we're going into a new year after a couple of tough years for agricultural commodity prices across the country. And the question at coffee shop conversations every day, I'm sure, has to do with farm value. Before we get into the question, can you tell me where people can find you on the internet, your address and so on?
Well, you sure can. It's landprollc.us, like Uncle Sam. Landprollc.us.
Oh. Okay, well, as we came to the end of 2016, where were we up or down on farmland prices for the year?
Well, across the Midwest and Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, let's say, all saw some decline. It really depends upon quality so much. Let's start with the very best soil. The very, very best is highly tillable, well-drained, and produces quite well. And Iowa showed a little bit more of a decline than Illinois, it looks like, and I think Indiana's right in there, too. But really, it's on an average of 5 to 8% down for 2016. And you say, well, that is amazing when you, from the high, you see corn down 47% from the very high to where we're at today. So it's amazing yet to all of us that the high-quality land still does maintain a relatively good value.
Who is buying that high-quality land, and generally what are they paying for it around the Midwest?
That's another great question, and for the most part, and let's probably divide this down a little bit. Let's go to smaller acreages, because that's usually where the higher prices are being paid for the 40s, the 80s, and usually at auction today by the high quality, the farmers who may find a property right next to them, and maybe it's next to the next guy as well, and they still see for the long term, which we got to understand, land is a long-term investment. It's not short-term in farmland. So they know that it may never come up for sale again in their lifetimes, and so they want to add it to their existing operation. And so those very, very high-quality farms could still go as high as $12,000 to $13,000 an acre. And you're saying, my gosh, how can you make that pay at today's corn prices? Well, you couldn't, but that's not the point. The point is long-term, and also there's still relatively low interest rates to leverage some of that if they so desire, and a few do. And so that's basically the best buyer we have today for the smaller parcels.
And for those folks who are a little bit younger and probably don't even know who Will Rogers was, Will Rogers, quoted many times, he was a historian and a comedian and all of that sort of thing. But he said, you know, when it comes to land, they ain't making any more. And I would guess that would be part of it.
I think it is, Orion. I truly do. And I think that what one, it's so localized, though. So these are generalities I'm speaking of, because I
right.
know that you'll find other situations where the land didn't rain that much in a local particular area. And it really is so economically based, as it should be, based on productivity, as I said, and the total tillable acres and a lot of the features of a farm that would make it more productive in this kind of an environment. When you get into lesser quality, higher non-tillable, drainage issues, we call a little hair on the dog, so to speak, then there's a differentiation even lower for those kinds of properties.
The property values can vary a great deal in Illinois, for example, where we have such great farmland in the northern part, the central part, and then do we see a drop-off in the southern part of the state when it comes to farmland values because of quality?
We always probably have, proportionally speaking, because other than around St. Louis, there's areas down there where when there is some development going on or there's other industries of commercial development, then there's 1031 buyers that will go further out from St. Louis to buy more land, which then creates a little higher value. That has happened from time to time. But from purely a productivity viewpoint, proportionally speaking, the values would be lower in southern Illinois than they would be in central and in portions of northern Illinois.
Are we still finding what we used to call the exchanges, where if you were close to an urban area and your land was priced much higher because of the possibility of building and that sort of thing, are we still finding the exchange event happening?
We do see some. In fact, I'm working on some real estate transactions right now that have 1031 tax-deferred buyers coming, but it's basically on other types of land they may be selling. It could be some commercial real estate. It could be something else that is also real estate income-producing, which qualifies them. And so they see farmland still as something they want to own. We will see some of the people here in northern Illinois who sold at the high end of the market in 1031 down to central Illinois at a much lower price. And now a few of them, again, from time to time, will sell their ground down there and bring it back north in a more depressed market up here as well to be closer back to home. So we do see a really amazing number of people, not what it was in 2012 and before that, but still a few from time to time are selling a tire store or something like that and say, hey, I always wanted that 80. And by golly, here they come.
Have we seen a great deal more sales coming through public auction rather than private treaty? What would be the percentage today, private sales versus the auctions?
I think the options are declining on all types of land just because if it is a not a good piece of ground, there is a strong possibility that it may not sell at the price that everybody had hoped it would. So I would say today it's down probably 25 to 30% from where it was at the high end of the auction market. But I will say this, on the high quality, and I've got one coming up here at the end of January 27th, it's a high-quality Class A farm, going to divide it in two tracks. I think it'll do quite well because if you just there isn't that much of that really, really good stuff out there for people to bid on.
I'm always fascinated when I see the breakup of the property into private tracks for sales. Does it happen very often that the first bidder will take everything, or does it go parcel by parcel?
It depends on the method of auctioning that the auctioneer does one and the size. Sometimes the way the auctioneer will process it, maybe there's more than one parcel, it's a bidder's choice. And so nobody knows which one that person may be bidding on, and there may be one, two, three tracked. And at the end of the day, end of the bidding process, the higher bidder may be bidder number two, and the auctioneer will say, well, all or which. You'll just only take number one. All right, here we start again on number two. So that can happen. Also, we see from time to time where they will bid on each tract and throw it into a combination. Say, okay, folks, now we've got the bids on all three. Let's now open it up for the combination. So we see both kinds. Sometimes that can be confusing to some buyers, so it has to be very well explained to people before the auction how that process is going to go. The whole idea behind the auction is to create competition, obviously, to get the highest price for the seller.
All you need is two people who really want the property, and yeah, hang on, because it can really go. What about non-farm investors? Are they buying as much farmland today as they did, say, 10 years ago?
I think there's even in some cases more than 10 years ago. I believe that the funds, and you know I work with some of those as well,
right.
They're very discretionary, but on a nationwide basis, and they're very diversified. So they're not just in the Midwest. Some are, but many of them are in four different regions in this country. And so they are very discretionary, very good at what they do, have really highly trained experts doing what they do. And so I would tell you there's a greater amount of those than there was 10 years ago, because from the fund standpoint, they still see agriculture as a really, really good long-term investment.
And I can remember so well the stories that kept going around that the Japanese or the Italians or the South Americans were buying up all of the farmland in the United States. Is there much foreign investment in farmland in this country?
Very, very little. In fact, my past years, I did some of that work with other employers, and most of them were from Germany. And during the Cold War period, that's where people wanted to bring their money in case they needed it out here. Most of that, or many of that, the younger generations from Europe have sold their land here in the United States and moved it back to their own country. So there's some yet, but very, very small compared to our domestic investments.
Okay, let's say a farmer listening this morning has decided it's time to wrap it up. I want to sell the farm, and I want to do it at public auction. What is the first step that he or she should go through? And then kind of take me through preparation for a land auction. What do the owners have to do?
Well, they need to make sure that, you know, usually there's a family situation where there's brothers and sisters or other relatives. They need to all agree, number one, that is what they want to do, because sometimes we'll see where one party says yes and the other say no. And that makes it very hard for us in the business to satisfy everybody. So they really have to agree that this is what's the best for the family. Maybe there's so many multiple owners at this day, it's time to distribute the cash and move on. Or maybe there's so many that the income is fractured to the point it's really not what they would want it to be. So that's number one. Number two, they shouldn't research the good auction companies that are out there in the states that they're in. There are some good people. They can go up on websites. They can find them, and then they need to call them and interview them, make sure, because this is a big decision, one of the biggest decisions you'll make in your life is selling that land. It may have been in the family for several generations, and you need to also understand what that auctioneer company brings to the table. Are they highly ethical? Do they do a good job from promoting the property? Do they advertise? Do they spend some money in getting that property out there? And do they understand that market? also, we all need to sit down and say, what are the values? I mean, in fact, people do get, when they're now no longer associated directly with the farm, they heard of the past values. They may not know today's values. So need to all understand that they have declined. They truly have. And so what we try to do when we sit down with folks is at some point after we've gone through a lot of the tillable acres, we need to know all that we can about the property as far as drainage, and maybe they don't know. So we research it ourselves as auctioneers or auctioneer real estate companies. We need to know everything we can that brings value to that property so there's no surprises the day of the auction. And as I say, at the very end, we need to say there probably needs to be reserve established so that when we get to a certain bidding point, is it a sale or is it a no sale? The last thing you want is a no sale. That stigmatizes the property for weeks or months to come because everybody there knows what was the high bid for that day, and they know if it did not sell. So it's a very exciting day. It can be very nerve-wracking that day because we all hope to do the best we can, you know. But it's one way. The good thing about an auction, it closes in 30 days from the day that we drop the handle, or the gavel. 30 days from them, you have your cash. That is part of the prerequisite of coming to an auction, and they have to be financed. There's no subject to financing. So that's a good way to go in some properties. So the main thing is we just sit down and we really evaluate the total picture. Honesty is the name of the game. That's the way it has to be done. And at the end of the period of time, we'll do the best job we possibly can.
Do you get an appraisal of the property from an independent appraiser, or do the auction companies do that?
No, the auction company probably should not. That's a conflict of interest. They can give a market analysis of what I will do. It's not an appraisal, but usually they could. The people can go out and do an appraisal. The thing about appraisal today is all based on past information, past comparable sales. So it's a basis, certainly is, but it's not necessarily at today's market. And that is one thing we have to understand, that the market is shifting. It's changing from time to time. It's changing in the area itself. So nothing wrong with appraisal. In fact, if somebody passed on and this is being sold in the state, there would be an estate tax appraisal anyway. So that's not a bad thing to have as a basis. But it's not necessarily. The appraised price may not be the actual price that one wants to offer or that property will sell at, because it's a matter of time that's involved.
And finally, on the auction subject, do all farms offered for sale at auction have a price that they have to get, or no sale? When and who makes that decision?
Well, I'm laughing. That's variable. We've worked with all kinds of folks, and some people really don't want you to know because they're afraid that you may not try hard enough to get the maximum price. That's really not true, but it is. It's a perception. So there has been times when we've done auctions that we went through the bidding process, got to a certain price. We brought the family together and we said, okay, is this it, or do you want us to call no sale? And usually we'll come to agreement. But most times prior to, and this is very, very private information, obviously, that just between us and the owners as to what they would like to see. But there can be a no sale. There are them from time to time. In our business, we sure hate that to happen, but it can happen because of maybe the owners were not realistic as today's market, or people just didn't show up. And that's one of the things that can happen in an auction process, is or the neighborhood kind of got together and said, you know what, we won't bid. We like Mr. Joe over there who's been the farmer, and by golly, we want him to have it. So there is some risk from time to time. One has to understand that.
And before we get to news headlines, a quick question on cash rent. What are we looking at this year, up, down, or stable?
Well, it's down. Unless somebody was really, really low and had to come up, and I think that's unusual. It was down on farms I manage through state of Illinois and other areas. I was down at least $25 an acre. Now, notably, I wasn't at the high end, but it wasn't the low end either. And so we did have to come down some. Who knows for 2017 with these grain prices the way they are?
Right.
Maybe looking at it again. I don't know.
Well, once again, let's get your address so that if people want to have a conversation with you, how do they find you?
Well, the phone is the best way to catch me. I'm a very personal relation person. I like to develop those professional relationships. So my phone number is
238-458-4800. 4800. That's where you'll find Ray Brownfield of LandPro LLC. And again, the email address?
LandProLLC.us, like Uncle Sam.
And that's it. That's where we'll find Ray. Thank you so much, my friend, for getting up early this morning to talk about the ongoing value of farmland. You have a great 2017.
You as well, Orion. Thank you very much.
Ray Brownfield with us here on the Saturday Morning Show, and we're getting up to news headlines time. We'll check in with Roger again in a moment. Welcome to Samuelson Says. Hello, everyone. I'm Orion Samuelson. This week, telling you, if it doesn't come from an animal, it's not milk. Wink Products Company has been providing professional strength household cleaners and other problem solvers for nearly 70 years. So when they come up with a new solution, people listen. Wink Lime and Rust Remover dissolves rust and hard water stains, soap scum, and buildup on bathroom sinks, shower doors, tubs, toilets, and tile. It even cleans lime scale off your humidifiers, tea kettles, and cookware. Find a store near you or purchase online at wink.com. That's WHINK.com. You've heard me talk about this many times over the decades, but there seems to be a growing interest in the subject, not only on the part of the dairy industry, but on the part of some members of Congress. I'm talking about labeling products milk that are not milk. They have not come from a goat or from a lamb or from a cow. There is almond milk, there is soy milk, but those products really aren't. They are a beverage. And I have been harping for years on the fact that while I love growers of almonds and soybeans, don't call your product milk. Instead, make it soy beverage or almond beverage. Because to me, if it doesn't come from an animal, it is not milk, and other products should not label it milk if it doesn't contain some fluid from an animal. As a matter of fact, I'm wondering if maybe the problem the dairy industry has with the labeling is not new. I grew up in the days when the dairy industry was plagued by the advent of oleomargarine. And the insistence on the part of oleomargarine manufacturers and processors to color their product yellow, the color of butter. And a long fight took place in America's Dairyland, for example, Wisconsin. You could not buy yellow oleomargarine. You could buy white margarine, and it would contain a little yellow capsule that contained yellow covering. And by squeezing that, you could make oleo look the same as butter. But again, with that product, it didn't come from a cow. It can't really be called butter. I understand. The reputation that milk and the dairy products have is indeed very good. And I can understand other products wanting to take advantage of that sincere belief in the goodness of dairy products. But let's not call it milk if it's a beverage. My thoughts on Samuelson Says. A presentation of Tribune Radio Networks here on the Saturday Morning Show. We're at 5:37 in the morning on a chilly morning in the Midwest, a little warmer in the Arizona area where we're joining you this morning from our, well, we call it WGN West Studios, where at the moment it's 50 degrees. I pass that along because the Farm Bureau Convention gets underway this weekend in downtown Phoenix, And for those of you making the trip to Arizona, it's cool at night. The desert does get cool. We haven't had frost yet, but it does cool down. So for the ladies, sweaters or jackets, and for the men, long sleeves might be appropriate for evening time. But we're looking forward to about 6,000 Farm Bureau members coming to the Valley of the Sun. And every time I broadcast from Arizona, when we spend time at our home here, I get emails saying, what are those restaurants that you and Gloria especially enjoy in the Valley? And so very quickly, if you're coming to the Valley, and these are Scottsdale restaurants, not downtown Phoenix, but our two favorites, once again, the Italian Tutti Santi. T-U-T-T-I-S-A-N-T-I, Tutti Santi, introduced to Gloria and me by Ron Santo. It was his favorite Italian restaurant, and so we always enjoy that. The other restaurant is the best outdoor patio restaurant in the Valley, but they're not dining outdoors now because at night the temperatures do get cool, but Lawns at Hermosa Inn in Paradise Valley. Lawns at Hermosa Inn, to us, best white tablecloth patio restaurant in the Valley. So for those of you who have emailed me, that takes care of that. And we're going to talk agricultural markets with Jerry Goodell when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. We begin with the first week of trading here in 2017 by talking to our longtime analyst and friend, Jerry Goodell. Jerry is with the Price Group, headquartered in Chicago. And as we look back over the year 2016, a lot of unusual events for me. One of the more unusual, the weather rally for soybeans in early June. What about you, Jerry?
Well, I think it was kind of a delayed reality of what was going on and some of the problems that were started in April and in Argentina's harvest situations and then some dry conditions that snuck into the late harvest situations in not so much soybeans as much as it really hit the corn market and their second crop corn, which really starts being a factor in that April and May periods. And all of a sudden, that factor, along with some of the tightness that has occurred in beans, put the two together, and we had had an unusual rally at that point. There's maybe a little bit of U.S. problems, but in general, no. But it's I think it's also made things quite interesting as we've come into the 2017 because of the sensitivity that we've kind of looked to here on South America, and as you kind of mentioned here. Off air, but you know, we're constantly talking about Argentina and Brazil now.
And it's a little bit opposite of what it was last year. Harvest was impacted by their rains. This year, it's planting that's being impacted, right?
Exactly right. In Argentina, particularly, this has really been a building affair over the last 6 or 8 weeks, but in reality of it, it's really became center stages here with the rains. The last two weekends down in Argentina that have been very significant between Buenos Aires and straight westward towards Cordoba, Santa Fe. That's really the heart of their planting areas in that, and because of the fact that that's also impacting some late wheat, that's delaying some soybean plantings, it's impacting corn that's already been planted. There's lots of different things, and now this coming weekend, we're not expecting a lot of short-term rain, but they're talking about rains coming back for next weekend. But also the focus has been also extended into Brazil because of the dryness that's kind of occurred from basically the eastern half of the general area of northern Brazil where the beans are being planted, or beans are being impacted, I should say. The western half is where all the production's at, Mato Grosso and western Goiás, but eastern Goiás and Viafa and Bahia, I'm sorry, I've very bad pronunciation in my Portuguese, and that they're getting some impact, and now there's some talk that that area is finally going to get some rain. And that's really the big impact today, is that the longer-term forecasts are projecting both in the European and American model for next week.
So that's why we're seeing the drop in soybean prices again today, mainly?
Exactly. A couple of days ago was the fact that it wasn't there. You go back and forth, as we all know in the U.S., we have the European and American model. If they get together and are seeing the same thing, everybody gets a lot more confident. 2 days ago, not so confident. Today, a lot more confident. That might change on Monday.
I know it could. Now, earlier this week, you sent me video of the flooding in Argentina, and I have to admit, I didn't realize that land is as totally flat as it is. There's nowhere for the water to run.
Exactly, and I think that's the part of the reason we had the rally that we did have, is that that video did pop up after the holidays here. Somebody was out really pointing out the issues that really Argentina has a whole different soil composition than Brazil, and particularly Mato Grosso, where that area needs rain on a constant kind of basis. And you get worried about dryness. Well, in Argentina, once you get a little, it's kind of like peat bog, if that makes any sense to the U.S.,
yeah,
in my opinion,
right,
that you get a little rain on that thing, it just keeps building, and all of a sudden it's just, there's no place for it to go unless you have tile, and guaranteed they don't have that, or drainage ditches, all the things we put in over the last 100 years.
About a year ago at this time, we were talking about China maybe slowing down its purchase of soybeans and some other ag products. Did that happen?
On an overall basis, by the time we got to fall, no, partly because of the fact that South America's crop size slipped, so they kept things going in the U.S. We've been really strong up until this week. This morning's numbers were, I guess you'd have to say, really disappointing with the 3.2 million soybeans. But I think basically we've been running at such a hectic pace all the way through this fall and up through December. I think we just had some people decide to take the week off during the holidays. I don't think the market's reaction today is really because of the export sales, but it's going to be watched again. But we're still way ahead on export sales. And I think the USDA potentially could actually increase their export sales projection for the 16-17 crop here because of the fact we're running 180, 200 million above the seasonal five-year average. Now, you can all debate this. When is the crop going to start coming from South America? Will they switch down there? All those things are going to be part of it. But once you get so far ahead of it, you're going to tend to kind of limp to the end and potentially could still have some expanded sales, particularly if we have problems down there in either one of those countries.
During 2016 crop growing season, we kept getting monthly reports saying it's going to be a record corn and bean crop in this country. Now, next week on Thursday the 12th, we'll get the final numbers from USDA. Are you looking for any surprises in that report?
No, not really. You know, once you get to this stage of the historical basis, you don't tend to have a lot of big adjustments. Back in the history of them here, if you go back and look at the relationships of these numbers, corn tends to have a situation where like six out of the last 10 years we've tended to have a slightly lower number, but we're not talking about a half or a bushel down at the best, or a bushel and a half. There, those numbers, and in reality, when we're talking about 15 billion bushel crop, it's not going to make a lot of big difference in that. It's still going to be, the corn side is particularly going to be focused on South America. Soybeans, there's been a tendency there, they're being down a little bit on the corn, on their average yield, and that, which won't make a big difference. On the soybean side, four out of the last 5 years, we've had a slight increase. But that's where I think the expanded exports could make a minor difference there. And in essence, I don't think the 480 carryover stock number we have right now is going to rise. There's been a lot of expectations of that maybe going up, but there's not a big long history of that. Of that number going up. And as time goes on, we could still narrow down that 480 as we go through the spring.
Now, as we look at 2017, there will be a lot of outlook meetings this winter for the next couple of months. If you'll be at any of them, what are you going to be telling producers they ought to be looking at for 2017?
Well, I think that the last year's extreme expansion of corn is going to be cut back, I think, pretty significantly. The range seems to be from between 4 million to maybe five. I don't know if we're going to get to six, but at least in the 4 to 5 million category on reduced corn, particularly in some of those areas west of the Mississippi here where they had some pretty big expansion from there. It's interesting in the fact that there's some idea that we could see some connection to the insurance program that people might get some payments here, but because of the fact that there was a basis decline versus a futures decline, there hasn't been a real big insurance payment generation because of this fall's low prices. Unfortunately, since the futures price didn't go below $3, it was cash prices, as we well know, were way down below $3 in the west of the Mississippi. On the bean side of things, that's expectation seems to be in that same 3 or 4 million category up. I think that's not it's something to be worried about on a longer term basis. But I think between now and March, or at least late February and March, there's still this uncertainty about weather and what's going to happen. And particularly at this point, if we get some extended problems in Argentina, that's going to end up reducing their beans and corn plantings. I think it's going to keep the emotions going. But on a longer-term basis here, we're going to be at the mercy of the world weather trends at this point. And right now, there's some people even trying to think that we might be back moving towards El Nino if you want to look at the Pacific Ocean. Other people were in a La Nina because that's what the kind of weather we had.
Are we looking at a lot of corn and beans still in farmer hands, or are they pretty well sold out the crop?
No. In the corn side, there's plenty of corn in producers' hands. Primarily, they've been, as they kind of were last year, kind of utilizing the soybean prices as to keep in their bank account a little bit full here of whatever that is, or in some cases, hoping that they're going to look for a rally. The bean side of things have been a little more attractive right now. We have seen, though, I'd have to say right now, the 357 to 360 prices here on March corn. With the basis, as we all know, being in this game as long as we both have, the basis relationships back against the D's and now into the March and how that's switched over, we are now getting back to some of the prices in the cash out there in the country that is approaching some of the midsummer prices of last year in the cash, or maybe just a little under it. But that's an interesting factor here. If we do have any weather problems in the corn in the near term, I think we will start to see some more producer markings in the corn because of the fact that they haven't been marketing the corn. But in reality here, that's a 370-75 game. I think that's particularly that came along here near term. I would recommend producers to make some sales in the corn for sure. And also stare at some of that new crop out there just a little bit. That would be over $4. We're at $3.85 today just to get started. But the one thing about the corn, if we do have any kind of weather that's negative, that 175 level we have this year is not likely to come back next year if we have any weather issues. If that slips down below 167, 168, things could change.
The one certainty we have, markets are never dull. And we thank you throughout the year, Jerry, for joining us to offer your expertise. And I hope 2017 will be a good one for you, sir.
Thank you, Orion. It's always good to talk, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Okay, that's Jerry Goodell with The Price Group here on the Saturday Morning Show. 5 minutes before 6 o'clock news time here on WGN Radio. Thank you for joining us here on the Saturday Morning Show. And I got some exciting news yesterday. Max Armstrong is going to be participating in the inaugural presidential parade on January 20th. Interesting story. There, well, the RFD-TV people approached the inauguration committee and said, you know, farmers should be represented in the parade. How about bringing 100 tractors to the parade? No, you can't do that. How about 50? No, you can't do that. How about 20? No, you can't do that. But they will allow 6 tractors in the parade. And Max will be driving one of them. He'll be driving a Case IH tractor. in the inaugural parade on January 20th. So it'll be exciting to get that firsthand account from Max as he participates in that bit of American history. Also, this week, the Consumer Electronics Show got a lot of attention in Las Vegas. It always does. But I was impressed by the fact that there were farmers and ranchers at the Consumer Electronics Show. The U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance introduced a new communications concept called Smart Farm, aimed at bridging the gap between the acceptance of innovation that's a part of consumers' everyday lives with the science and technology happening on today's farms and ranches. We have visited before with Brad Greenway, who is the chairman of the USFRA. He's a hog and crop farmer in South Dakota. And he talked about their appearance at the Consumer Electronics Show. He said science and technology are embraced by consumers in all aspects of their lives. Well, we want to demonstrate that farmers and ranchers are using similar technology to produce food in a way that's good for the soil, air, habitat, and water on and around our farms and ranches without compromise on cost, quality, or taste. So in the coming year, USFRA will incorporate programs and activities such as 360 videos, infographics, events, and speaking opportunities to demonstrate smart farming practices. And they did that at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas this year, this week. So good for them. Glad to, happy with John Deere and the Climate Corporation because they showcased Smart Farm at their booth at the electronics show. Well, as we ended the first trading week of the year, it was a pretty much red screen in the grain soybean market. And so come Monday, the March wheat contract will start at $4.23 a bushel. The March corn contract will start at $3.94 a bushel. And January soybeans will start Monday below $10 again at $9.86 a bushel. Soybeans particularly took a heavy hit yesterday, down 16.25 a bushel. And in livestock trade, up and down yesterday to end the trading week. February lean hogs ended the week at $63.97, down for the day. May hogs up slightly for the day at $73. And pretty much the same story for live cattle futures. February live cattle ending down 10 cents a hundredweight, 114.82. Meanwhile, April live cattle gained 17 cents at $114.20, and the January feeder cattle contract gained 25 cents yesterday at $128.32. Well, again, the American Farm Bureau Convention downtown Phoenix, Arizona, starting tomorrow, continuing through next Wednesday morning. We'll be there to cover many of those events, and we'll share them with you here on WGN. But again, if you're a Farm Bureau member in the chilly Midwest this morning, yeah, you'll find temperatures a little warmer. Daytime highs maybe mid-60s to 70s as we continue to get some stormy weather off the Pacific Coast. But anyway, welcome to Phoenix. And we'll look forward to seeing you there at the Farm Bureau Convention. And that's our time for this morning on Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.